those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Good morning, I'm Herb, and welcome to Community Spotlight. Each week I try and bring an individual or a community or a community event or a topic to talk about on Community Spotlight. And this morning I have Healthy Headwaters and Creek Bug Collecting, which will be part of the Black Gully Festival this year. And I've got Sarah Micker to help me. Good morning, Sarah.
Hello, Herb. Thank you very much for having me.
I think we'll have a great chat. This is right up my alley. So you came to Armidale in 2002, you tell me.
I did. I studied at the University of New England and then came in 2002 to do my honours. I think I told my mum I was going to be gone for 3 weeks, but I absolutely love Armidale, and I stayed, and I did my PhD here as well.
But I think you did a bit of your PhD at Muswellbrook.
I did. I spent 3 years down working in the Hunter catchment, and I was studying surface water groundwater interactions and how we restore those, because that's very, very important for... It's like the liver of a river, and so a lot of ecosystem processes are important to maintain the surface water groundwater connection.
So you're at ecosystem management at the UNE?
I am. I'm a senior lecturer in aquatic ecology and management.
Oh, very nice. So tell me your first memory of wanting to go into aquatic ecology or limnology.
Limnology, yes. I knew I wanted to work in environmental science, but I didn't know what. And so during my undergrad, I harassed as many people as I could to go and do field work. And I did a lot of things, and some of which I thought, well, I actually don't want to do that. And then I asked Andrew Bolton, who was the professor of limnology at the time, and he took me down to the Bellinger River, and we walked upriver looking for the perfect experiment site. And I thought I would do this for a holiday, and I couldn't believe that there was a job I could get paid to work on rivers. And so coastal rivers and freshwater systems, I found my love.
All right, but that's later in life. I'm talking about a childhood experience. Was there something in your childhood that might have sparked a green interest?
I was very lucky. I grew up farm halfway between Brisbane and the Gold Coast, and it started off as a dairy farm and then kind of went into beef, and then eventually, as suburbia got closer and closer, a horse adjustment, which was great for me because I was horse crazy. But we had creeks there, we had dams there, we had a spring. And so growing up, I played, and we spent all our time outside playing. Dad would whistle when it was dinner time, and we'd come back in. And so I knew I wanted an environmental science job, but I hadn't picked up on freshwater science until I went down and saw the northern New South Wales rivers.
No, very nice. So we're talking aquatic ecology and limnology, but we're actually talking, in layman's terms, the life in freshwater ponds and streams. So tell me about the life.
I find them fascinating. Like, they only take up a really small amount of space on the planet, and yet they have so much life, so such a high biodiversity. They're disproportionate in the amount of, or the number of species that they support. And so they're critical habitats. They're impacted by sort of surrounding land use. And so we all live in a catchment. We all kind of impact these freshwater systems. And obviously humans rely, and you know, other animals also rely on water security and good water quality.
So we're talking about some of those impacts, those human impacts, like stock grazing on our creeks, the removal of riparian vegetation, that's the vegetation that is along the edges of the creek. Those types of impacts have an impact on the freshwater ecology of the river, would that be correct?
Absolutely, and especially where we sit in the New England, where we're on the top of the Great Dividing Range. So we're in the headwaters of Gwydir to the west, and also the Maclay, sort of from Armidale down to Euralla to the east, and then up north into the Clarence. And so we sit on the headwaters of some really important river systems, and so our land use here has a disproportionate effect on those catchments.
So the other thing I'm thinking of is we have so many willows and those exotic trees that seem to be along a lot of our river systems. Do they have an impact on the ecology of the river?
They do. I'm not recommending that we just go and cut them out, because often they're the last remaining riparian habitat, and so they are supporting a lot of native species, small birds and species that rely on riparian vegetation. But willows actually do have quite an impact on river systems. So we know they're deciduous, they drop their leaves, and their leaves are very soft, and so they decompose very, very quickly, and so what happens during that decomposition process is that the microbes build up, because they've got all of this great food, and they consume all the oxygen out of the water. And so we tend to get these hypoxic or low oxygen events in autumn when the willows are dropping their leaves. They also are really good at, like, you can see their root mass go down into the streams, and so their roots go between the cobbles, and they actually remove a lot of the kind of little niches that water bugs live in. The habitat. And so they simplify the habitat, and they consume a lot of water.
So that's the creek-lined trees, the exotic trees, the native trees. But let's think about the vegetation that's in the creek. What sort of vegetation are we talking about that actually is aquatic in nature?
There's a lot of different types of in-stream plants, that and a lot of them are native. And so we have the ones that are fully submerged, and they form really important habitat, so for all of the water bugs that live in them. And then we also find that you'll have these emergent reeds and rushes, and they live usually during on the stream side in the shallow things. And they're really important because as the water bugs move from their larval aquatic stage into their terrestrial aerial stage as adults, they actually need to be able to climb up onto structures to emerge. So we know that their wings come out, they're soft, and then they need that kind of time. And if we don't have those emergent reeds and rushes, then we kind of lack the structures for the water bugs to be able to come up and emerge out, you know, for what we recognise damselflies and dragonflies flying around, the adult stage.
And I suppose just on that point about our human impacts, if things are out of balance, so there's too much nitrogen or phosphorus, whether it's the leaf fall from the willows, or whether it's some sort of discharge from a dairy, or even just too much stock pressure on the river, we get a balance in the water chemistry, which then throws out a lot of the vegetation. So we get filamentous green algae, that big long green slime that we see, or blue-green algae, all that type of thing. So it's really critical that we actually protect the health of those creeks, particularly in the headwaters, so we don't have that imbalance.
It really is, Herb. Headwaters, they're small systems, and we don't tend to, they're not the iconic systems that we see with the big sort of river systems. Overall, they take about 70 to 80% of the entire sort of stream network when you are just in length of sort of waterway. They have a huge impact on the health of the entire sort of catchment down to the estuary, and the water quality issues that can emerge from those headwaters will impact then, you know, all the way down into the larger freshwater systems, and then also into our estuaries and down into our coast. So protecting the headwaters, and as you said, nutrients are one of the key issues there, and the water chemistry. So the water chemistry throughout that whole catchment is really, it develops in the headwaters, and they're such unique systems from kind of very small catchments. There's so much of them. They're like, if you like, the capillaries in our system. Without, you know, you can lose one and it's not too much damage, but overall that capillary system is doing a huge job in kind of moving nutrients around, supplying things like organic matter, that's the food for aquatic ecosystems, and then also sediments and water temperature as well. So all of those things are affected by what we do in the headwaters, and that kind of effect is just then accumulates down the system.
Yes, no, definitely. So you did mention insect larvae. I mean, we did mention the different insects that are around the creek system. But those that live part of their life underneath the water, we'll call them macroinvertebrates, what are they?
Australia is very fortunate that we have very high diversity in our macroinvertebrates. Other countries aren't so fortunate, and particularly on our Eastern Fall rivers, very, very high biodiversity. And they have a range of different, so there's such a large group of macroinvertebrates. So that's invertebrates that are larger than a centimetre. There's predators, so some of those dragonflies are really big predators in the system. There's things that break down, so they're shredders. They take sort of whole leaves and they break them down. Yabbies are a really good example of an important shredder species. And then that creates food for other invertebrates that sort of go along and take up the small particles. And that is a really critical, that they're central to aquatic food webs. So they take organic matter and they process it so that energy then can enter into the aquatic food webs. And then there is, you know, that they're a diverse community, so some water bugs are eating other water bugs. But importantly, they're really important prey species for a lot of vertebrate species. So we have fish, like Australian bass. We have water birds that also rely on the aquatic macroinvertebrates. And things like rhaecali or water rats and platypus. Also, their major prey species are these macroinvertebrates.
Yeah, I think what we're pointing to is that you can go to a creek and think about the fish, the turtles, maybe the platypus or the rhaecali, if you're lucky to see those, and the water birds, but and crayfish, and maybe the shrimp.
Yes.
But until you actually start investigating those insect larvae, and you talked about dragonflies, and we've got damselflies, mayflies, that are above the water, until you actually start investigating what their life cycle is under the water, there's a whole world that opens.
There really is, and I guess two things from that. The first is, although they're aquatic, as you said, Herb, a lot of them have these terrestrial adult stages. So they move away from the water system and they move out into the surrounding sort of landscape. And so it creates this huge energy subsidy to the surrounding landscape. So things like our terrestrial vertebrates, our reptiles, our lizards, our frogs, our snakes and spiders, they all eat these like aquatic insects when they emerge out. So there's this huge energy transfer from the aquatic systems out into the surrounding terrestrial landscape. So they're supporting not just aquatic food webs, but also the surrounding terrestrial food webs. And then secondly, because we have this diversity in Australian river systems of all these different macroinvertebrates, and we've studied them, and so we know a lot about them. And that means that we can look at the community composition there, and they integrate water quality and food quality, habitat quality, and they integrate all of this. And because we know so much about the individual ecology of all these different types of species, we can start to, it's like an integrative long-term understanding of the health of that system. And so because there's so much research into this kind of keystone group of animals within freshwater systems, when we go out and we collect those macroinvertebrate communities, it tells us about the health of the system.
So you can score by the diversity and abundance of the certain macroinvertebrates that you might collect. You can score the health of the river system.
We can, and it's a really useful tool because the different macroinvertebrates like different things. If you like, they're a little bit like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. There's some that don't like heavy metals, and so if they're not in the system, we know that that might be a problem. There's others that are really sensitive to nutrients or sediment or low oxygen. And so by looking at the different species that occur and also the ones that don't occur that we should expect in that habitat, it tells us what might be the kind of impacts that are affecting that stream.
But we talked about the riparian vegetation just before, but would it also be true to say that not only the water chemistry, but the structure of the riparian vegetation, so if we had a very nice stream that had good water quality and was native overhanging vegetation, a good natural native riparian zone, that would actually improve the signal score for the macroinvertebrates?
Absolutely, and for a number of reasons. Healthy streamside or riparian vegetation is one of the most important things that we can do to improve or maintain the quality of these systems and, or the health of these systems. So as you said, the different sort of riparian vegetation, the root mass helps to maintain the stream banks so they're not eroding. And so that stops the sediment coming into the waterways. That sediment, while it stays on the hill slopes or the floodplain, that's your topsoil. So it has the nutrients in it that help agricultural productivity or support, you know, natural biodiversity. When that sediment goes into our river systems, it's a problem because they're not used to dealing with nutrients. Our natural systems are, in Australia, are used to having very low nutrients. So as we, you know, talked before, when we start to get excess nutrients, we tend to get algal blooms, or that can be, you know, a cause for algal blooms. Also, the native vegetation tends to drop its leaves across the whole year, and so there's this constant leaf fall, and they break down slower, so we don't get that real pulse of leaf fall in our systems that consume all the oxygen as they're decomposing.
Like the willows.
And so planting up or protecting native vegetation not only provides better habitat for all the animal species that use those river corridors, such as small birds, but it also provides a much higher food quality. It's the comparison would be, you know, going and eating fast food all the time. Willows are a little bit of a fast food organic matter supply, whereas if you've kind of got the native vegetation, you're getting, you know, a balanced diet, if you like. And that's the same for the water bugs. And so vegetation, stream-side vegetation, is critically important because it shades river systems, and particularly in those headwater streams, the channel's quite narrow, and so the shade effect of the stream-side vegetation is very high. And we know that when we lose that, and we lose that shade, and we've got direct sunlight hitting those streams, we tend to get more algal blooms in those streams, but also the water temperature starts to heat up. And so again, if we're looking at protecting our streams, we want to create those thermal buffers. And so having good native vegetation that provides shade is really important for the health of those systems.
So while we're still on macroverbates, I'll put you on the spot.
Mm.
What insect larvae family is your favourite? I know what mine is, and I'll tell you after yours.
I think dragonflies. Yeah, dragonflies. They're amazing. So, you know, when you're sitting and watching, like, the adult stages, and they've all got their tiny little rock patch, and some of them, when you're working in the stream, will buzz you because they're quite territorial, and they're also beautiful. And they last in rivers for quite a while. They might spend a year in their larval stage in river systems, and that before they emerge as adults.
I think for me, mayflies, and the particular one, Leptophilibidia, Japper.
Oh yes.
And I love that that macroinvertebrate, that insect larvae, because of all the breathing filaments and feather-like structures that it has on its thing. But also, I like the Japper because it's probably one of the most plumed of the mayfly larvae. But I love the story. It was named Japper, supposedly after the Japanese black and white movies back in the day, where they would use actual animals, lizards, crayfish, things in the movie, you know, to superimpose over, you know, buildings being destructed and people running away and things like that. But so that's where Japper, Leptophilibidia Japper, comes from.
Well, you've taught me something, Herb. I did not know that, but they are a beautiful water bug and their gills are amazing.
I think let's move on to Black Gully Festival this year. You've got the Healthy Headwaters and Creek Bug Collecting Talk and Table. Tell us about that.
We do. So my team and I are going to be there, and at 11 to 11:30 I'm giving a presentation on healthy headwaters, so explaining the importance of them and then also how we can look after them. And I think that's in the pack saddle. At 11:30 and then also at 1:30, my team are doing a creek walk and then collecting samples. So we're going to go out and collect some bugs in Black Gully. And we'll have a stall there the whole time. We'll have microscopes. We'll have live bugs. And so just come and have a chat to us. We've also got a map of the region so that people can have a look at where they live and find out what catchment they're sitting on the top of.
Yeah, and you use a special net, don't you, a 25 micron net to catch all your little bugs so you don't get them. So, yeah, and put them in a tray. So if you don't want to get in the water, and you want the kids there to stay dry and not dirty, just have the kids there on the side of the river, outside of the creek, our Black Gully Creek, and your people will bring what they've collected into the tray, and then you can sort them and the kids can see them, maybe take them back with the microscope, or even just a I think that's the great thing with macroinvertebrates, you don't need a microscope so much, but you can see them quite well with your eyes, but also with a magnifying glass.
And that's true. So they're hard to see in the net because they're all kind of grouped up, but we will put them into white trays with water and then they show up on that background. We'll have a microscope there. I think we'll have some magnifying glasses there. We've got some nice keys so people will be able to actually go through and identify what water bug they've got, and then also sort of understand what that means for the health of the system.
And I think the Black Gully here is a perfect example. We do have a few exotics on the riparian zone, but there's been a lot of creek planting with native vegetation, and that's sort of an ongoing thing for the Black Gully reserve area here. So it'll be interesting to see what macroinvertebrates you get in the creek.
Yes, they've done some really good revegetation work down on the creek land, so it'll only get better.
So we're talking healthy headwaters and creek collecting with Sarah Mucker and Monique and her group from Ecosystem Management at the UNE. They've got a stall at Black Gully, so get down there 11 to 11.30 at the Neeram Pack Salary for their talk about all things bugs and riparian. But the creek bug collecting, you can go with them, with the group, at 11.30 and 1.30. But the store will be there all day for the Black Gully Festival.
It will.
Well, I think we'll wrap it up, Sarah. Thanks very much for coming in and talking to me. And I'll have to get you back and talk about what your group do around our region apart from Black Gully.
Thanks for having me, Herb. I'd love to come back. I love talking about freshwater systems.
And that was Community Spotlight with Dr. Sarah Mica from the School of Ecosystem Management at UNE Armidale.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.